This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. The price of lumber is up, and American sawmills are seeing big business. And the upswing is all thanks to a little-known trade dispute that wasn't started by President Trump. We'll have that story coming up.
Like many states, Colorado has a teacher shortage, and low teacher salaries are a factor. But when we talk about that, we may be leaving out one particular group of educators.
People don't realize we work all year long. People don't realize we do a full curriculum. People don't realize everything that goes into what we do.
In this episode, we go inside the life of a preschool teacher.
There are a lot of jobs that require employees to protect their hearing, but there's one industry where it's still not a priority, but probably should be.
When I would go into the recording studio and the producer is saying, you know, you're flat. And I'm saying, no, I'm not. I'm dead on. I don't know what you're talking about.
We'll meet a group who's helping musicians protect their hearing.
Plus, Howie Moshevitz reviews The Bookshop.
The Bookshop. Well, I thought he was our film critic. What is he doing in a bookstore?
I have no idea. I guess we'll find out.
I guess.
But first, Colorado will soon have some of the strictest consumer data protection laws in the country. As KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, new standards for business and government take effect September 1st.
Starting this Saturday, any company or public office storing a Colorado resident's name and personal information must have these three things: a written data protection protocol, a method of disposing of said data when no longer needed, and a system in place to notify customers within 30 days of a breach. State Representative Cole Wist co-authored the new protections.
Folks are at risk every day. If you think about the fact that one in four consumers are victims of a data breach, waiting another 6 months or waiting another year to implement this, I think, is the wrong approach.
Wist says entities that don't comply with the new law could be held responsible for economic losses stemming from future breaches. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
Colorado's Public Utilities Commission gave their final approval to a proposed $2.5 billion investment in solar, wind, and natural gas power in the state. Minneapolis-based Xcel Energy is seeking to build several large-scale renewable energy projects and also retire two coal-fired power plants in Pueblo. Now, Commissioner Wendy Moser warned that the closures will have impacts.
The customers of Xcel Energy will pay for the retirement of these plants, and it will show up in rates. So don't think this is free and it's going to be borne by somebody else.
Critics of the Colorado Energy Plan argue it will cost Pueblo about 80 coal jobs in total. Supporters say construction of wind and solar farms will benefit rural community economies and strengthen Xcel's renewable energy portfolio.
For decades, the road to the governor's mansion in Colorado has gone through Grand Junction. The nonpartisan group Club 20, which represents Westslope counties, has usually hosted the first debate between the candidates. But because of a scheduling conflict, Democrat Jared Polis cannot participate this year. KUNC's Michael DeJoanna just got back from the Western Slope, and he talked to Kyra Buckley about the fallout.
For those who may not be familiar with Club 20, can you tell us more about them?
Yeah, the group originally represented 20 Western Slope counties, but now it's 22.
All right.
They didn't want to change their name. Club 20 has a bunch of subcommittees. They take positions on issues that are critical to the Western Slope.
And even though it's a nonpartisan group, some say that it leans to the right.
True, especially if you look at some of the issues they support. But keep in mind, the counties on the Western Slope are historic Republican strongholds. Now, that's changing. There are several these days that tilt Democratic, and there are large numbers of unaffiliated voters throughout the region. Club 20 knows this, and it isn't always predictably conservative in its stances.
So then on to Jared Polis. Why can't he attend?
It's not politics, according to his campaign. It's because he has a scheduling conflict. I asked his campaign spokesperson, Mara Sheldon, for specifics about that, and she told me he has a personal prior family commitment.
But as we've previously reported, he did offer a surrogate to stand in for him that Club 20 turned down.
That was Lieutenant Governor Donna Lynn. She's one of the candidates who Polis beat in the Democratic primary. But Club 20 Executive Director Christian Reese says candidates have to debate for themselves. I met her at a cafe and rifle about halfway between Glenwood Springs and Grand Junction.
We reached out to the campaign and said, you know, we just can't allow this.
Club 20 gave Polis about a week and a half to respond, and that deadline has come and gone.
And we never heard anything back from the campaign. So at this point, we are moving forward with a single candidate for that gubernatorial time slot.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, the Republican nominee, Walker Stapleton, is going to debate alone?
Yeah, I suppose it won't be much of a debate, but he'll be there to answer questions. And I should add, there are minor party gubernatorial candidates, but they didn't meet the thresholds to appear at the debate.
So what's been the reaction to all of this?
For starters, a concern that a longstanding tradition might be over. And a recent editorial by the Journal newspaper in the Four Corners region wondered if Polis was trying to avoid the conservative Western Slope in favor of campaigning in the Denver-Boulder areas.
Tell me more about the voters. How are they viewing things?
The few I spoke to feel that Polis is out of touch with the Western Slope, and that hurts those who are campaigning for him. Gretchen Brogdon is the chair of the Garfield County Democrats, which urged Polis to participate in the debate.
It is significant. I'm not sure how it would hurt him to participate, but it would certainly help our efforts if our gubernatorial candidate showed up.
You also said there are a lot of unaffiliated voters on the Western Slope. Any idea what they make of this?
No, but about 38% of the state's active voters are unaffiliated. That's more than either of the parties, and they are the ones that candidates on the right and left want to sway. In Newcastle, I met with Randy Fricke. He's a former Democrat who ran for Congress more than a decade ago. Now he's working to organize independent voters around central issues like increasing Democratic participation.
Jared has a lot of money. He's got a pretty good campaign. His platform is pretty strong. But I think he needs to venture out in this part of the state and tap into this changing data, especially with independent voters.
With so much at stake in the western half of the state, what is the Polis campaign doing to dampen the view that he's out of touch by missing that Club 20 debate?
This is definitely not the impression they want to give. In fact, Mara Sheldon, his spokesperson, says Jared Polis has visited the Western Slope about 36 times and plans to go back over the Labor Day weekend. He's also committed to other debates with Stapleton, including the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, Rocky Mountain PBS debate. So there's a chance to see the both of them debate.
Sounds like Western Slope voters will be the ones to ultimately decide which debates are important.
Indeed. And I should add, this has triggered ads and counterclaims about whether Polis is committed to the Western Slope. So we'll know more heading into Election Day if this issue is a blip or one that defines the race.
That was KUNC's Michael DeJuana talking about the reaction from voters and Club 20 on Democrat Jared Polis not attending their debate that's scheduled for September 8th. For KUNC, I'm Kyra Buckley.
Back in May, we hosted our first Java with a Journalist, a community listening event, and resident Sarah Marsh attended. She's heard our ongoing coverage of the state teacher shortage and the role low salaries play in it, but she wanted us to know that this also affects another group of educators that no one is talking about. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel explains.
Sarah Marsh will tell you straight up, she loves her job.
I love getting to know the kids. They're so funny and creative and goofy, and they're people.
She works with 4 and 5-year-olds as a preschool teacher in Erie.
The moment where a kid first zips their zipper is amazing. They feel so powerful. They can do it themselves, and they just have this look, and it feels so cool to be there.
But what Marsh doesn't love is the pay. She's been teaching for 7 years.
I make a few dollars more per hour than I did as a hostess in high school at a restaurant. And that is the most I've ever made. And I gotta be honest, I'm really excited about what I'm making right now.
Her school day is jam-packed, teaching 10 lessons from music and reading to teaching students how to deal with their emerging emotions. And these are young kids, so there are frequent bathroom breaks. She says the list just goes on and on.
I so often feel disrespected and not valued for what I do, where we serve this young population and we're the people making it possible for like 80% of our workforce to be at work.
So while the teachers make very little, the cost of preschool is very high. At a community school in Fort Collins, parents pay an average of $1,000 a month.
So this is our parrot classroom. These guys are all 3.5 to 4.5.
Heather Griffith is the owner of the Young People's Learning Center. About 70 kids attend preschool each day. So if the average monthly cost is $1,000 and there are 12 months in a year, that's about $850,000. Should be a nice profit, right?
Almost all of our costs are driven by staff pay.
The state mandates that preschool classrooms have one teacher for every 8, 10, or 12 kids, depending on their age. The average hourly wage for a preschool teacher in Colorado is about $15 an hour. So even though Griffith pays her teachers from $11 to $16 an hour, the wages still add up. Between payroll, supplies, and administrative costs, she says her profit is only about 10%.
Cost is always a thing in childcare. We don't pay teachers enough, but we can't charge parents more because they don't have it. So that's always a balancing act and is super tough for everybody on all sides.
We're also in a real crisis in Colorado and nationally with respect to preschool teachers' pay.
That's Diana Shack. She's an assistant professor of education and human development at the University of Colorado, Denver.
The knowledge and skills of the preschool teacher is the single most important factor in high-quality preschool.
But in Colorado, about a third of these educators are on public assistance. And she says the low pay has led to turnover rates of up to 44% depending on the job.
Right now, two people are bearing the brunt of this flawed system. Parents who cannot afford to pay more, and teachers who cannot afford to stay in the field.
So if raising parent fees won't work, then how can we increase preschool teacher pay? One way is to ask voters. Summit County plans to do that in November. Voters there will decide on a measure that would increase property taxes to raise almost $9 million. About a quarter of that would fund early childhood care and learning. But it will also be competing with a statewide tax question that would also raise money for preschool through secondary education.
Liam, do you want to come say something in the microphone? Do you want to say hi? No?
Back at the Young People's Learning Center in Fort Collins, owner Heather Griffith agrees taxes are a good way to get more funding for preschool and teacher salaries.
So we are going to have to, as a society, decide this is important and put money into it, or it's going to fall apart.
Sarah Marsh has worked several preschool teaching jobs and has finally found one that offers partial health benefits and gives her almost 2 weeks of vacation a year. She just wishes she could make more money.
People don't realize we work all year long. People don't realize we do a full curriculum. People don't realize everything that goes into what we do. And I really want people to know. I want it to be important because it is.
For KUNC, I'm Stephanie Daniel.
We have a lot more great stories to get to. Get comfortable. And I have to say it because I'm a huge audiology nerd. If you're listening with headphones or earbuds, maybe check the volume.
Yes, absolutely. I wear headphones every day, and I'm not always thinking about how important it is to protect your hearing. In some jobs, hearing protection is actually mandatory. But in the music industry, that's not really the case.
I do have some ringing. Not a whole lot, but I've noticed that in the last year. Usually have to ask what a couple times.
We'll find out more about a group who's working with musicians to think about protecting their hearing before it's too late.
It's seriously something we should all pay attention to, whether you're going to concerts or playing on stage.
Unless you like that ringing in your ears the next day.
Not a fan. Later, we'll hear how we review a film about a woman trying to open a bookstore in a small village where no one is quite what they seem.
But before we get to that, the price of lumber is up, and many American sawmills are doing great business. So are the rural communities where they reside. As KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, it's all because of a little-known trade dispute that wasn't started by President Trump.
Back in 2012, one of the largest employers in Montrose, Colorado, a sawmill, nearly closed its doors for good. These days, to keep up with the increasing demand, Workers like Dennis Long are putting in 10-hour days.
I don't think a lot of them are going to complain too much about it, especially when they see their paycheck every 2 weeks. That's always a kicker for them.
Production is up about 20% from 2 years ago, and Long, who's worked here since the 90s, says right now business is exceptional.
I think our output's a lot better than what it ever has been.
When the sawmill does well, so does the city. According to one estimate, it brings $32 million to the local economy. Things are so good that sawmill owner Jim Nyman says he's investing $20 million for additional upgrades to the facility, something he would have never dreamt of doing just a few years ago.
Well, there's a number of factors. Market's one. The consumer confidence has restored. The Canadian tariff is a big part of it.
That's right. He said tariffs. Technically duties, but the two terms are often used interchangeably. They might sound like something that would come from the current White House, but the tariffs, which have been in place since April 2017, are the result of a long-running trade dispute that dates back to the 80s. The U.S. needs Canada because we can't meet domestic demand for lumber on our own. But after the most recent agreement expired in 2015, the two countries were unable to negotiate a new one. And about a year and a half later, tariffs were imposed. Nyman says companies like his just want a fair deal, and these tariffs level the playing field.
When another country can supply wood cheaper into this country than we can here, something's wrong.
The U.S. Lumber Coalition argues Canada can produce cheaper lumber in part because it harvests timber from public lands, and the government determines the price. America logs mostly private lands, and the lumber prices are all determined by the market. The tariffs may be great for the lumber industry, but trade experts say it damages other U.S. industries. According to the National Home Builders Association, the tariffs have added almost $9,000 to the cost of a new home. And the association's survey found the cost of lumber is now a bigger issue than the nation's shortage of construction workers.
It doesn't sound like much when you're talking about a $500,000 house, but in aggregate, it adds up. The costs of protectionism are far greater than the concentrated benefits.
That's Dan Eikenson, who works for Cato, a free market think tank. He says we should do away with the lumber tariffs entirely, even if they are helping sawmills.
Look, when we open up the competition, and that's what trade is supposed to do, it's supposed to encourage us to specialize, there are huge benefits from having access to lower-priced lumber.
Right now, the Canadian government is hoping the U.S. will come back to the negotiating table to do away with these tariffs and agree on another long-term deal that works for both parties. But Eikenson says the Trump administration has quite a few trade disputes on their hands. He says Trump might fold this into his NAFTA renegotiations, but it's more than likely the Canadians will be left waiting.
Now for several months, there have been no negotiations ongoing on this issue.
Canadian Consul General Stéphane Lizard says his government does not subsidize lumber and that the U.S. tariffs are illegal. In fact, the Canadian government has brought this issue to the World Trade Organization before and won. And now they've gone back to the WTO.
And we're very confident that they will find again in Canada's favor.
American sawmills are thriving, but Lazard says ones in rural Canada are hurting. They're cutting back hours or laying off workers to survive what for them has become a tough market. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on farm and food issues and is a collaboration of KUNC and other public media stations in the Midwest. Business for American sawmills may be booming right now, but the Colorado River is currently experiencing one of its driest periods in the last 1,200 years. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more.
New figures from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation show the river system has a 57% chance of experiencing serious water shortages by 2020. The likelihood then goes even higher in subsequent years. The bleak numbers come as water managers attempt to negotiate agreements that would cut water use before a shortage is declared. In a statement, Reclamation Commissioner Brenda Berman said the situation is urgent, given the Southwest's growing demand for water and the ongoing drought. She's giving water managers until the end of the year to finish their plans. For KUNC, I'm Luke Runyon.
There's a lot of important equipment that musicians take with them when they go on the road, like instruments, speakers, microphones. But there's one more thing that is often overlooked, and it's the one thing that can make or break a career. KUNC arts reporter Stacy Nick found out what the most important equipment really is.
For more than a decade, a typical workday for Anthony Kovacs sounded a lot like this. Kovacs was the lead vocalist for the Chicago punk band Shotbaker, and even when he wasn't on stage, he says his daily life was pretty noisy.
When I wasn't on tour, I was working in music venues as a door guy or whatever I was doing, and so I was exposed to loud quite a bit. And at some point, I noticed that my hearing wasn't as sharp as it once was, and it actually started scaring me into wearing hearing protection.
Now his days sound more like this.
All right, let's have a quick look at our ears here.
Now he's Dr. Kovacs, the audiologist. And today he, along with several University of Northern Colorado audiology students, are in Fort Collins attending the music festival Bohemian Nights at New West Fest.
It was so loud last night that my ears were itching when I left that show.
The green room of the music venue, the Armory, has been turned into a makeshift waiting room, and it's packed with musicians and others in the music industry. They're here to get free custom-fit earplugs.
You're going to feel kind of like you're going underwater here.
Okay.
Not going nearly as deep as it
is. Whippoorwill guitarist and banjo player Stacy Foster looks a little nervous about the long tube of silicone-based goo that's about to be inserted into her ear. But she's recently noticed problems with her hearing.
I do have some ringing. Not a whole lot, but I've noticed that in the last year. Usually have to ask what a couple times.
Foster admits she doesn't wear ear protection when she's performing, and even when she's at concerts as a fan.
I just get different kinds of earplugs, the little cheap ones. And if I don't have any, I'll usually grab a napkin at the venue or restaurant that I'm at and just shove them in my ears.
Dr. Kovacs isn't surprised that hearing protection hasn't been a big priority for musicians. There can be a lot of barriers.
With hearing protection, it can be challenging to communicate on stage and to, you know, hear your instrument with as much clarity as you need to. So it's challenging.
Traditional foam earplugs let in the bass and cut down the treble, Kovacs says, kind of like when you hear music at a party next door. Custom plugs cut down all the frequencies evenly.
So it's almost as if you just turn the volume down.
Kovacs didn't start wearing hearing protection himself until he started noticing a problem.
When I would go into the recording studio and the producer is saying, you know, you're flat, you need to sing in key. And I'm saying, no, I'm not, I'm dead on, I don't know what you're talking about. And he's going, no, you're flat. And I'm arguing with the producer about whether I'm flat or sharp or whatever.
Which is why the group Music Cares has been offering free earplugs to musicians. It's just one of the national nonprofit's outreach efforts, which include health care and alcohol and drug addiction counseling for musicians and others in the music industry. People like John Morse, the president of the local stagehands union, arrived with several of his employees to get fitted for earplugs.
Let me check your ears, make sure I didn't leave any souvenirs.
Okay, sounds good.
For 52 years, Morse has been working in theaters and music venues. He says hearing protection was never a priority.
We didn't think about it early on. Been probably wearing hearing protection for maybe 3 or 4 years only.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Have you noticed any hearing problems?
They're holding up pretty well, thankfully, and I want to make sure that continues.
And for Dr. Anthony Kovacs, who still does the occasional show or recording session, one of his missions is spreading the word about hearing protection, especially to those who make music a major part of their lives. For KUNC, I'm Stacy Nick. The new film, The Bookshop, is about a woman who opens a bookstore in a charming seaside village in England. And, I mean, who wouldn't want a bookstore in a place like that?
I would love that.
KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says in this case, the entire town seems to be against the idea.
The Bookshop could be one of the most understated films ever made about thoroughly malicious people. The movie just seems to sit patiently with people talking quietly or saying nothing at all, at times barely moving. The camera itself remains placid as it observes with little comment. You wonder what's going on, but slowly the picture reveals itself, and at that deliberate pace unfolds a story of genuine malevolence. With the exception of a youngish woman, an oldish man, and a frizzy-haired little girl, these are some of the worst people ever to inhabit a movie. And there's not a single gunshot or knifing, no one buys, sells, or uses drugs, there's not even a car chase. And actually, there can't be more than three or four cars in the whole movie, and one boat. The Bookshop takes place in a perfectly picturesque village on the southeast coast of England. Old stone buildings, narrow streets, lots of greenery and flowers, and of course the sea. It's 1959. Florence Green, Emily Mortimer, loves books and decides to open a bookshop in an old and long unused building in the village. She gets a bank loan. She talks up the shop at a party given by the haughty grand dame of the village, Violet Gamart, Patricia Clarkson, and even to the ferryman. Oddly, just about everyone tries to talk Florence out of the idea. Florence is a gentle woman who loves books and hopes to make them available to the locals. She takes a few chances. It's got to be a stretch when she orders 250 copies of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, not just for the kind of people who live in the village, but it's hard to imagine 250 people total within reach, much less book buyers who will go for that book. At its height, the shop seems so well stocked you have to wonder who's doing all that reading. But the shop's lovely and comfortable. It's the bookshop of your dreams. But town dowager Violet Gamart does not want a bookshop in that place. She wants her art center, and she wants it in the very building where Florence both lives and runs her shop. Violet puts up a subtle but dreadfully insistent opposition. It's a falsely soft version of big-time city politics. A building inspector finds serious problems. Some child labor questions arise about the kid who helps out after school. And there's a traitor who at first looks like an annoying but harmless cad and turns out much worse. And that's how the bookshop works. No one is what they seem, and it takes a while for both Florence and the audience to make their way through the layers of indirect language and subtle gestures to find the nastiness within. Maybe it's because director Isabel Coixet was born in Spain and now works in England that she has an outsider's take on the downside of English politeness. At any rate, once you see where the film's going, the slow unpeeling becomes delightful. The movie depends on actors who can handle that conflict of gracious appearance and vicious fraud. Bill Nighy plays Edmund Brundish, a rich old recluse in the village who reads and strikes up a sweet friendship with Florence. He doesn't like Violet Gamart. The confrontation between Nighy and Patricia Clarkson is a wonder of performance that's like fencing. The two of them hint and faint. They're nearly still but for their eyes and understated shifts in their postures as they sit and discuss not just the bookstore, but probably the past 50 years of barely hidden hatred for one another. The two old codgers are masters of weaponized social proprieties. It's a thrill to watch. To say the least, The Bookshop comes in under the radar, but that's good. It's a pleasure to let the film sneak up on you until you finally realize how much it has to show. And it ends just as it should. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was supported by you, our KUNC members, and produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Erin O'Toole. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson contributed to our show. Ashley also manages digital. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
Other music in this episode is Dead from the Beginning, Alive Till the End by Dr. Turtle, Chad Crouch with Green Winged Teal, Kiss the Sky by Scott Holmes, David Hillowitz with Transformations 2, and So Far As I Know with the song Confluence. Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
And find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.